Today's Teisho will be on case 79 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pienlu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 79 is entitled Tosu and Every Voice is the Buddha's Voice. Engo's introduction, the great way manifests itself naturally. It is bound by no fixed rules. The teacher does not have to exert himself to bring his students under control. Tell me, who was ever given such an example? See the following. Main subject, a monk said to Tosu, "It is said every voice is the Buddha's voice. Is that true?" Tosu said, "Yes, it is true." The monk said, "Master, don't let me hear you breaking wind." Tosu gave him a blow with his stick. The monk asked again. The sutra says, rough words and soft words both lead to the first principle. Is that true? Tosu said, yes, it is true. The monk said, Master, may I call you a donkey? Tosu gave him a blow with his stick. Secho's verse, Tosu, Tosu. The wheel turns unchecked. One shot, two victories. That blow, this blow. Pity him who mocks the tide. He will fall in it and die. If he suddenly comes alive, 100 roaring, surging tigers. Today is day two of our May Sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for sitting so splendidly this morning. Everybody did a wonderful job. Those morning sits are really quite special. We get up early and come in here and recite the sutras, and then we have tea. And then we come back and we sit down and have the first sit of the morning. And it's a very deep sitting. Everybody was sitting very still. And did a wonderful job. And in the subsequent sit, everybody sat still. It's very, very beautiful, wonderful practice. Yesterday was a beautiful day, don't you think? It was in the 80s, and but not too hot, you know, like low 80s. It was sunny, breezy. It was really very beautiful, and everything was so quiet, you know, very quiet. It was like a sunny, perfect day. And then last night, storm clouds rolled in. The temperatures probably dropped 20 degrees. And looks like it's going to rain, but it hasn't rained yet. And all around us, all kinds of commotion is going on. It's like a different world, yeah? It's very important to understand what Zen practice is really all about. It's not about making a distinction between yesterday and today, or between one sit and another sit. This is very, very important. If you make a distinction, you're not in your biggest mind. we recite every morning verses on the heart mind. And it says, gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. And, you know, yesterday I was talking about this book I've been reading, In the Buddha's Words, an anthology of discourses from the Pali Canon. And these are earliest teachings of the Buddha. And I read something yesterday, and I want to read it again today. It's called the Dart of Painful Feeling. Monks, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose someone were to strike a man with a dart and then strike him immediately afterward with a second dart, so that the man had a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he experiences two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. And I think that's quite profound, you know. This is like a theory of trauma, actually, you know. So basically, things happen and we form a mental image of those things. We form a mental attitude towards those things. So, you know, if you get a new bicycle, when you look at that bicycle for the first time, you might think, oh, this is really a wonderful gift, you know, brand new bicycle. And you get on the bike and you go for a ride, and maybe you have an accident and you break your arm. Yeah? Well, the next time you look at your bicycle, you don't see it the same way. This is the two darts. Right? You've suffered a physical injury, but also the mind is now, the mind has now taken on a particular attitude towards the bike. This is really very perceptive. And after that, it's not possible, maybe, for a long time to look at your bike the same way. You know, when people are young, sometimes they fall in love. And if you fall in love very profoundly with somebody, it can be a wonderful experience, but then it's possible that person will treat you badly. Maybe the person betrays your trust. And the relationship falls apart. Next time you are involved with a person, it's quite likely that the first relationship will be there too, like a mental after image in your mind, coloring what you experience. You know. So you know, this point that the Buddha makes, I think, is really quite profound. That it's just not true that we move through the world with an impartial mind. You know, it's not true that we move through the world with a mind that is simply able to experience the world as it is, because we've had these painful or negative events, and they shadow us and color our experiences of the moment. I think it's quite profound. So we suffer, he says, two injuries when we're injured. You know, one is the physical injury, you fall off your bike. The other is like the mental habit of being anxious or fearful. And the Buddha says, you know, really what I'm trying to do is to free you from your habitual responses to things. One way to Well, let me read you a little bit more of what he says. He says, you know, the uninstructed worldling sees life in terms of gain and loss, right and wrong. He actually uses very similar language. He says, but people who follow the Dharma, who follow the way, no longer experience things that way. He says, but monks and nuns, when an instructed noble disciple comes upon gain, he reflects thus, this gain that has come to me isn't permanent, bound up with suffering and subject to change. And so he will reflect when loss and so forth come upon him. He understands all these things as they really are, and they do not engross his mind. Thus he will not be elated by gain and dejected by loss, elated by fame and dejected by disrepute, elated by praise and dejected by blame, elated by pleasure and dejected by pain. Having given up all likes and dislikes, he will be freed from karma, from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, pain, dejection, and despair. He will be freed from suffering, I say. And I think that's really quite important to understand. It seems to me that this is like, all of us, especially in the modern world, want to win. And we want to win. I get a catalog in the mail, maybe you do too. It's from a company called the Kripalu. Kripalu is a yoga center in New England. And it's up in a beautiful part of New England, on like 300 acres of protected land. And people go there, and it's reasonably expensive, you know. And you can go through like a healing process at Kripalu. And so, you know, I think about people who have many stresses in their lives and have faced many defeats and disappointments, maybe. And maybe they're getting old and they realize that the better part of their lives are behind them now. And so they want to make a change in their lives and they go up to Kripalu. And it's this beautiful place, beautiful buildings designed by world-class, actually they just added a new building which was designed by a world-class architect. And you look out the window over a lake and forest, it's quite lovely. And people do various kinds of yoga exercise regimens during the day, which are, you know, challenging. And you eat very good food, healthy food, and there's lectures on different aspects of life. And people can leave Kripalu feeling healed. Yeah. Now, this is really a wonderful thing for all the people who go there. But it's not exactly necessarily liberation. See, it's not necessarily liberation because very, very subtly such a place is creating distinction. It's creating a kind of mind which is actually like clinging mind, a mind that wants to win. I don't know if this is making any sense, but you know, even if you build a beautiful monastery and you have a place where people can come and sit, they can turn it into another occasion to win. You know, in other words, you know, when life is not satisfactory, there's a part of us that wants it to be satisfactory. That's what winning is all about. So if you have a job you don't like, you can quit your job and get another job. That's an example of how we try to win. Another example of winning is that you could be in a very unhappy relationship, and you could get divorced, and you could try to find a better relationship. You could decide that you can't stand New Jersey anymore because of all the traffic and all the and you could move to upstate Vermont or something like that. You know. These are all attempts to win. This is so human, right? And I'm not saying you shouldn't quit your job if you have a terrible job. And I'm not saying you shouldn't get a divorce if you're in a terrible relationship that's very unhappy. And I'm not saying you shouldn't leave New Jersey because there's many lovely places to live. But all the same, there's a part of us that thinks this way, you have to admit. That when we find ourselves in an unsatisfactory circumstance, we dream of a more satisfactory circumstance. And the so-called spiritual quest can be understood in these terms too. In other words, you know, we can imagine that that what we are doing by going to Sashin is improving ourselves or gradually getting closer to enlightenment. See? And when we go to Sashin, we could imagine that we're going to change our circumstances and improve our circumstances. Now, in a certain sense, this is definitely true. Yeah? So actually, if you come to Sashin, and you go through Sashin a couple times, I think you will discover that you've become a more patient person, less quick to anger, and more kindly, probably, eventually. I mean, just sitting in pain for a week can make you a kinder person, you know? So in a relative sense, it is absolutely true that if you're miserable in your job, changing your job is a good idea. If you're miserable in your relationship, changing your relationship is a good idea. If you're miserable in New Jersey, it's definitely a good idea to move to Vermont, you know, and that sort of thing. But in another sense, all situations are equally unsatisfactory. So ultimately, Zen practice is not about trading one condition of being for another condition of being. From the Buddha's way of thinking, that would not be liberation. That would just be changing one form of illusion for another form of illusion. So Zen practice is really not about improving ourselves. It even though it does have that effect, it does make us better people. Even though it does make us kinder, more patient. Even though it does change the way our brains work, and so on and so on. Ultimately, it's not about that. It's about living in a way where gain and loss, right and wrong, cease to matter. And this is what the Buddha was talking about. So this is a rather unusual teaching because it's possible to see it as pessimistic. It surely does make a difference if you have a more satisfying job. But ultimately, I think if you examine your work situation, you'll find that no work situation is better permanently. You know, my friend Richard Miller came here to Rutgers from the University of Florida, and he was so happy to be at Rutgers. And he wasn't very respected at the University of Florida, but at Rutgers he was able to accomplish many things. And anybody who looked at his situation would say, you know, you made a good move by coming to Rutgers. But just recently, my friend went through a series of setbacks at Rutgers, where basically he fell out of favor with the vice president of the university and the dean, the new dean, and basically he is no longer going to be department chair, and so on. So suddenly he was had this wonderful job, and actually he wound up taking antidepressants for a while. And I would say, actually, through no fault of his own, really. It's like circumstances just changed on him, and what had been a satisfying situation suddenly became an unsatisfying situation. And I would say that there are philosophies, and also there are ways of cultivation which are based upon becoming a better person and achieving a better circumstance. So, you know, it's possible to do Zen for the positive things it will do for you. You know, so for example, if you have trouble concentrating, doing meditation will help you to concentrate. It really will. It will really make a difference. It helped me. In fact, there's some evidence that doing meditation will actually increase your IQ. So if you'd like to get some more IQ points, please keep sitting. I can use all the IQ points I can get, you know. So I'm happy to hear that it might have improved my intelligence. I thought I was much stupider at one time. Maybe Zen has helped me, you know. But the thing is, it's not ultimately about being smarter. It's a different mind than that. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. And if you are beyond gain and loss, right and wrong, you're where the Buddha went in his life. It's not about improving your situation. It's about being free from situation. If that makes any sense. You know, years ago, I was invited by a group of Universalist Unitarians to speak about Zen Buddhism and the environment. And there was a place up in North Jersey, a Unitarian community, and every week they would have, or every month they would have, a guest speaker talking about a social issue. And somebody had read something about Zen, Buddhism, and nature. And so, you know, there's a lot of nature in Zen, a lot of nature imagery and, mountain, references to mountains and rivers. And so the person asked me to come and talk about Zen. And I disappointed everybody so much. It was one of the many talks I've given that haven't worked out so well. But I said, you know, if you look at the global situation, it's almost certain that things are going to be changed forever. And I was just written, I cited some of the statistics, you know, like right now 80% of all the clams in the ocean are gone. And fish stocks are at a low, all-time low, and so on and so on. So I went through these kinds of statistics, and I said, what you, I said, I understand you Unitarians believe in God. And he said, yes, we do. And I said, well, how are you going to keep believing? Do you think God is good? I said. They said, yes. And I said, well, how are you going to keep believing in a good God when the polar bear goes extinct and the lion and the tiger, et cetera, et cetera? And I said, because those animals are going to go extinct. So how are you going to believe in a God's goodness and in your own goodness? And they wanted to throw me out of the room, as you can imagine. It wasn't so much that I seemed to question their goodness or God's goodness, because I didn't. I asked them how they were going to keep believing in it. But because I didn't say things are going to get better. I said, you know, things sooner or later are going to, are not going to get better. So what are you going to do about it? How are you going to live? And that was not what they wanted to hear. They wanted me to rally the troops and save the world, you know. Sometime after that, I read an interview in Tricycle magazine with a teacher, a Tibetan teacher, and somebody asked him, what do you think about, you know, the environmental crisis? Don't you think that this could be the end of the world? And he actually started laughing. And he said, well, everything has to end. See? Now, that's a shocking statement. Very un-American, right? Because the American idea is that we are going to find a better situation. And this has become like the modern world's idea. If you're in an unpleasant situation, you can find a better situation. And in a relative sense, that's fine. Please do so. So, you know, I don't want to discourage anybody from getting more education, looking for satisfying relationship, pursuing meaningful work, and also trying to save the planet, because those are all noble enterprises. But there is a certain sense in which there's never going to be a satisfactory situation. And so this practice is about being being beyond situation. Beyond situation. This is very important. See? So what the Buddha didn't teach was a superior, the Buddha didn't teach was like superior way of life, actually. You know, superior knowledge, you know, superior situation. He says, don't be dependent on situation. So as soon as you say, I prefer this to this, you're a million miles from it. I think this is right here in this early teaching. All forms of Buddhist practice can become misleading. If you think you're getting closer to the truth, you know, if you've answered a certain number of koans, and you think, okay, I'm closing in on enlightenment, I'm getting closer and closer. Or if you think I've gone to X number of sesshins, I'm closer and closer. Or if you're thinking back on past sesshins, and you're longing for the successes of past sessions, all of those are a million miles from it. You know, you can't, the Buddha said you can't get free by holding on to anything. You can't get free by holding on to anything. So please let it go. So let it go. You know, or put it down, let it go. And that's very difficult. I mean, that's why we have to get up at 4:30 in the morning and sit all day, because all day long we're trying to win. All day long we're trying to achieve a preferable situation. And I am no exception to that, you know. I too have this desire to have like preferable situation, better situation. And at the there's a certain point during every sesshin where I just feel like, okay, I give up. I give up. And that is a very important moment, in my opinion. That's really very close to what the Buddha taught. I give up. Yeah. And that's a different mind. There's no situation which is going to be satisfactory. I'm going to stop looking for a better situation. And we have to sit all day, and maybe many days, right? Because we're always trying to like maximize our advantage. That's human. So I'm not. You shouldn't feel ashamed. You shouldn't be angry at yourself if you feel that, you know. But Zen is there's and relatively speaking, if it's cold, put on a coat. If it's hot, take off your coat. This is natural human behavior. But there's a certain point, if you sit long enough, where you say, I don't care. I give up. And that's liberation. Now, there's more to it than that, you know. But that impartial mind, there's nothing to gain, nothing to lose. That impartial mind is like so important for Zen. You know, as long as you're striving to improve your situation, you're not in the moment with an impartial mind. Now, you can't force yourself to be an impartial mind through like an act of will. You know, you can't say, okay, that did it. You know, I'm still striving, I've got to stop this, you know, stop it. And that's not going to work. You have to, you know, basically stumble into impartial mind. And that's why a mechanism like sesshin is so important and so precious. Because we come to sesshin with all kinds of aspirations, all kinds of aspirations for a superior situation. Every one of us has had disappointments and is in some way trapped, fighting, struggling, squirming like a fish in a net. And so we come to sesshin because we want to get out, we want to be liberated. And all day long we're trying. At some point, you know, sooner or later, it might be the last sit of the day, you know, where you just say, screw it, I give up. And that's deeper mind. And, you know, it's in the koan collection, at one point in the Mumonkan, it says Master Mumon says, if you hit him with a stick, he won't even move. So that's somebody who's really deeply in that impartial mind. It's like sometimes your mind is in this state which is absolutely imperturbable. It's unmovable. An imperturbable mind. And it's like if you were hit with a stick, you wouldn't turn to look, you know. Now this is not hopelessness in the conventional sense, right? It's not hopelessness, even though hope is a kind of a drug, actually, you know. Hope means I'm looking for a better moment. So it is true that in this state there's like no hope. But it's far from being a negative condition. You know, the Buddha talks about joy. When you say, that's it. I give up. You know, when you really, well, usually people say I give up when they mean I don't give up, right? You know, screw it, I give up. That means I'm really bitter because I didn't get the payoff that I want. So sometimes when people say I give up, they don't really mean it. They mean I can't give up. And I'm bitter because I haven't won. But sometimes people really give up. They really give up. And that's what Zen practice, that's the Buddha's way, is really giving up. Really, and it, you can't will yourself to do it. It might take 9 hours a day for 7 days. It might take 63 hours on the cushion, and maybe times, many times. But sooner or later, you just give up, and you experience the world in a very different way, this impartial mind. It's easy to say, this koan says, a monk said to Tosu, it is said every voice is the Buddha's voice. Now, you know, there's a way of misunderstanding that, right? This morning, very early in the morning, there was wind blowing, and the wind is so beautiful. And it's possible to say, oh yes, you know, how beautiful, the wind is the Buddha's voice. You know, oh, the wind is. And that is true. Wind is the Buddha's voice, so to speak. But then there's another part of us who hears the beep, 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 and says, that is not the Buddha's voice. See? Western people often translate in their minds, like, you know, if I hear the wind and I'm a very religious person, I might say, the wind is the voice of God. See? The wind is the voice of God. So when somebody says that every sound is like the Buddha's voice, it's like saying every sound is the voice of God. But that's not quite what the koan is getting at. See, it doesn't mean hold on to this wind as a precious gift of God. It means don't hold on to anything. See, that's different. Yeah? It's different. Don't hold on to anything. As soon as you say, oh, this wind is really beautiful, this wind is... Now, it's not a sin or a failure to say that. Please appreciate it, but it's hard, takes hard work not to hold on to that, right? So you're sitting here this morning and you hear the wind and maybe you think, oh, how beautiful. And then beep, 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 and you think, oh, damn it, now that's no good. See, now that's not an impartial mind. That's not a mind that's you're making a judgment. In Zen we talk about dying on the cushion. So when you hear the wind in the proper way, it takes your mind to a place that's absolutely impartial and empty and blank. Yeah? And in that state, gain and loss, right and wrong, are no longer present. And that's the state of bodhisattva. Yeah? And when you are clinging to the wind, you say, oh, how beautiful. See, you know, it's possible to go to Sesshin and just have like a mental scrapbook of beautiful experiences. So you go to your Sesshin and you say, oh yes, you know, there was that beautiful day yesterday with the sun and pieces of flowers were falling out of the trees like snow. It was like the flowers from the locust trees were falling like snow on the ground. And it's a beautiful image, right? And it's possible in your scrapbook of beautiful experiences from Sesshin to put that mental picture there. But really and true, and that's okay. If you're doing that, that's okay. But actually, that is in a way creating another barrier. You know, what we really want to do is to go into deep mushin and be an impartial mind. And in that state, that state is not, it's not dead and lifeless as you might think. It's not unhappy, pardon me, it's not joyless and, you know, unfeeling and so on and so on, but it's quite different from ordinary judging mind that says this is good and that is bad. Every sound is the voice of Buddha, not because it's beautiful, but because it takes us back to the source of sound. Everything we see is Buddha because it takes us back to the source of sight, the source of feeling, the source. What is that source? Now, when you hear, who is it who hears? When you see, who is it who sees? This is actually a very intelligent question. And what's the source of this seeing? What's the source of this hearing? Where is it coming from? You know, I said if you listen to something and it takes you back to mu, that's good. That's what it means to hear with the Buddha's ears. But tell me, where does the hearing itself come from? So to answer that question, you have to be in a very special mind. Maybe the monk knows that, you know. Tosu, and every voice is the Buddha's voice. A monk said to Tosu, "It is said every voice is the Buddha's voice. Is that true?" Tosu said, "Yes, that's true." And the monk said, "Well, what about when you fart? Don't let me hear you fart." Tosu gave him a blow with his stick. Why did he do that, by the way? Is it because the monk understands or he doesn't understand? Maybe he doesn't understand yet. He says, every sound, well, how about beep, beep, beep? Not that one, surely. And the teacher hits him with a stick. Okay? The monk asked again, the sutra says, rough words and soft words both lead to the first principle. That's like saying, beautiful wind and beep, beep, beep should both take your mind back to the same place. If they don't, you have to do more zazen. So he says, beautiful wind and beep, beep, beep both take your mind back to the same place, the first principle. Is that true? Tosu said, yes, that's true. And the student says, well, can I call you a donkey? Tosu gave him a blow. So who knows what the monk understood. I've mentioned this before, but you know, there's a very famous Chinese monk named Shuyun, Empty Cloud. And if you have a name like Empty Cloud, you really have to be empty, you know? So he really was. And Shuyun, I've talked about the fact, would go into such deep samadhi that he could sit for days without moving. And many witnesses saw him sit for days without moving. Once he was living by himself up in the mountains, and he made some rice, and he put rice in water and started it to boil on some twigs. And when he came out of samadhi, the rice was cold. It had cooked and turned cold. So in a deep samadhi. Anyway, he's become quite famous in China. And a bunch of Buddhists and Buddhist scholars and admirers of Shuyun had a conference. And they invited one of Shuyun's students. And one of his very able students. And you know, they said, "Oh, please come to our conference. You knew the great Xu Yun, who could sit for 7 days without moving." And they had, after he was introduced, somebody had a cool question. They said, "What about his attainment? You know, his ability to sit for 7 days without moving?" And the student said, "Listen, he could sit when he wanted to sit, and sometimes he thought sitting was good, and sometimes he didn't sit. But if you're talking about attainments, you're not talking about the Buddha's way. You know, this is about, there's nothing to attain. There's nothing, fundamentally nothing to attain. Now that takes a lot of sitting. But when you are in nothing to attain mind, everything takes you back to the same place. Yeah, Mushin. Mushin. How does that happen? Please investigate." And also, you become aware of sound, sight, and so on, where does that come from? Who is hearing? Who is seeing? So today, everybody is really practicing deeply. Please tear up the scrapbook of beautiful experiences. Don't even start one. This is a deeper path than that. A deeper, deeper path than that. This is not about attainment. It's not about answering koans. It's not about winning. If it were, it wouldn't be worth doing, in my opinion. To live in this mind is real freedom. Real freedom. Nobody's freed by winning. Nobody is ever freed by winning, in my opinion. Nobody's freed by having. Nobody's freed by so on and so on. You can see where that's going. This is about letting go. So please, you know, all day long, moment after moment, please just keep letting go. And that means following everything back to move. Everything back to move. Okay?